Welcome to Voices of Simpson. I'm Steve Horsfield. I serve as Executive Director of Simpson Housing Services. As this first episode of our podcast debuts, we mark Simpson's 40th year, housing, supporting, and advocating for people experiencing homelessness in and around the Twin Cities. So much in life depends on whether or not you have a safe, stable place to lay your head at night. Health, income, caring for a family, achieving your goals, it really all starts with housing. And on any given night, about 20,000 Minnesotans go without it. At Simpson, we've been doing this work for a long time, so we've learned a few things along the way, but we still have a long way to go. We invite you to join us and to learn more about what we all can do to address housing issues, whether you're a consistent Simpson volunteer, supporter, or you're hearing about us for the first time. Bottom line, we can't do anything without the support of the community, you. In today's episode, we'll learn about Simpson's history, how we've changed to meet the community's needs, and perhaps the most important question, where do we go from here? Thanks for tuning in. It's wonderful to be here together.
I'm Rachel McIver-Morey, a United Methodist pastor who served at Simpson United Methodist Church from 2013 to 2015, where I also served on the board of Simpson Housing Services from 2013 to 2015. And I'd like to share Simpson's story. So it's 1982. We're in Minneapolis's Whittier neighborhood. It's scrappy and eclectic, home to artists and immigrants, and fairly recently, a big Kmart store the residents have taken to calling the Berlin Wall. And just like pretty much every major city in the United States in the 80s, folks are sleeping outside. The reasons why are complicated. Let's simplify things by calling it a perfect storm of massive budget cuts, a recession, gentrification, federal disinvestment in housing, and, this probably sounds familiar, lack of affordable housing. Like we said, complicated. Just east of Nicollet Avenue, the congregation members of Simpson United Methodist Church are starting to take notice. The legend goes that when they saw their neighbors sleeping on the steps of the church building, the men of the church decided to get the government's approval to offer shelter for anyone who needs it. And the women, supposedly, just kind of opened the doors and said, come on in. That's the origin story of Simpson Housing Services, a shelter in a church basement, which was open a few nights a week. But it doesn't end there. Over the next 2 years, more and more people started showing up, seeking shelter. The need wasn't going away anytime soon. So Simpson started its first programs designed to help folks transition out of shelter and into housing. By 1993, it officially changed from a faith-based organization to a nonprofit. This wasn't just about Christian charity anymore. This was about filling a void in the structure of the community. And quickly, the Simpson team was realizing the solutions to insufficient housing were also pretty complicated. More complicated than giving somebody a bed for the night and expecting them to suddenly get back on their feet. There was more to be done. In the following years, Simpson kept expanding its services to address the complexity of that perfect storm. It added programs specifically for children and hired its first educational advocate in 1999. Other services would follow: rental assistance, the Housing First program, early childhood support, middle school mentoring, harm reduction, anti-racist training for staff. Simpson kept growing. It got smarter. It learned by listening to shelter guests and participants, people who knew the experience of homelessness and what it was like, and what they really needed. In 2018, a large tent encampment of unhoused community members began to organize near Minneapolis's Franklin-Hiawatha corridor. It became known by some as the Wall of Forgotten Natives because its residents, many of them indigenous, had been forgotten or left behind by the systems created to assist them. Simpson was selected to operate a temporary housing shelter called the Navigation Center and assist guests in connecting to services and finding permanent housing. Over a five-month period, well over half of the 175 residents found permanent, stable housing. In 2020, as the pandemic set in, Simpson was one of the first shelters in the area to officially change its operations to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so people could safely shelter in place. It's remained 24/7 ever since. A few years beforehand, the church that started it all officially gifted its building to Simpson. Maintaining the building, which is pretty old by this point and was never designed to function as a shelter, has always been a challenge. But ownership also provided an opportunity. Simpson leadership started discussing the possibility of building a new shelter and new supportive housing right on the site. Fundraising is now in progress with hopes to break ground in 2022 or 2023. So that's where we are now. Homelessness still exists. So does Simpson. Stay tuned for a conversation about where we go from here and how we can better house, support, and advocate for people experiencing homelessness.
Thanks for that, Rachel. Now that we know where we've been, let's talk about where we're going. I've worked alongside Mikkel Beckman for nearly 20 years. Mikkel is the Hennepin County Housing Coordinator, and we share a belief that housing is a human right. I was recently honored to be in conversation with Mikkel about the future of shelter and housing. So, Mikkel, welcome to our podcast. I'm very happy that you're able to join us today.
I'm glad to be here.
You and I have known each other for a long time. For those who don't know you, could you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got into doing this work?
Sure. I'm Mikkel Beckman, and I work for Hennepin County. I work in the housing stability area where I focus on upstream homeless prevention and eviction reduction work, and also trying to fulfill a personal vision that has now become part of the county vision, which is to live in an eviction-free community. And so I've been working a lot in housing court with partners there and in the prevention realm, trying to prevent homelessness as much as possible. I started working in a homeless shelter in 1990, a shelter for drinking men who were on the streets, and ended up working at the Harbor Light Center, managing the special needs shelter there. And really got tired of people dying of AIDS in the shelter I was in who were unable to access the healthcare system because they were primarily poor men of color who were IV drug users at the time, and got into supportive housing development and was part of a team that helped build some of the first family HIV housing in America, as well as housing that became Hope Harbor, which is a 96-unit apartment building downtown for very low-income single adults. And went on to manage programs, homeless programs at Catholic Charities, then worked at Corporation for Supportive Housing, helping communities and tribal governments around the state of Minnesota develop supportive housing for homeless people with disabilities. And then became the executive director at St. Stephen's and did that for 8 years. And then left to join the Office to End Homelessness and get that systems level perspective at Hennepin County.
So first of all, let me just say thank you for your 30 plus years of dedicated work on these issues, Mikkel. I know I've had the opportunity to learn from you quite a bit and develop some things together. One of the things that I love about doing this work in this community is the degree of collaboration that we have amongst agencies and with government partners. From what I gather from my peers elsewhere in the U.S., that's not always the case, to have this intense level of collaboration.
Well, and I think just those partnerships are key. I mean, those relationships, and there is room for everybody in this campaign to end homelessness. I think here locally, we've been able to just sustain relationships and commit to finding the time to just gather and have these conversations and plan together and scheme and dream and complain and advocate. I mean, especially when you think about Simpson Housing and its roots in the Simpson Methodist Church in a community that gathered, and in the continued strength of those roots in what you're doing now. One of the reasons I think there's been so much progress here is because of the roots that are watered and sustained and the honoring of all of that work. Whatever your role is.
Yeah, we took ownership of that church building a couple of years ago. And one of the things that I really felt kind of come, frankly, heavily on my shoulders at that point in time was an obligation. And it was not only to move forward the mission of Simpson Housing Services, which has been working for 40 years, but it was really to perpetuate a commitment to social justice and community engagement that's more than 100 years old at the intersection of 28th and 1st that the United Methodist Church really laid down for us and would ultimately birth the agency.
And I would say that most of the shelters in our system have come out of similar roots, whether it's in the Lutheran tradition or Catholic or Muslim or Jewish tradition. There are many of these communities, and to see them all link up early on in this struggle back in the 90s and start to communicate and reach out to each other and build a network that is what it is now is really interesting to me.
Yeah. You know, the foundation of the way that the work is done at Simpson is very much this notion of being in relationship. And Robert Hoffman, our shelter manager, he likes to say that the conversation begins with a new shelter guest along the lines of, what does a 90-day path back towards housing stability look like for you?
I mean, when I think about that, relation is the key word to all of this work, I think. I mean, even when I was at St. Stephen's, I never liked the word funder or donor, you know, whether it was a government funder or a donor, because those are just byproducts of being in relationship with partners or with individuals. And the basis of that relationship is a common hope or a common goal or this social justice work. And that those are critical relationships.
One thing I like to remind people of is, as a 501c3, as a nonprofit, we really are nothing more than an expression of the community's will to do something about housing instability and homelessness. I mean, that, God willing, there'll come a day where we've done our work and we can pack up and the community can focus these resources on other issues.
Exactly. And I think the foundational impulse is solidarity, that to be in solidarity with people who literally have lost a lot of things and are on the streets. The way you can be in solidarity with someone you don't even know is through a 501c3 or through your involvement in an organization. And that's important. Sergio Lozcano, who's a Mexican writer and intellectual, he says there's no faraway place left on the planet where this connected, you know, small world. But he says there's only two geographies, the geography of above and the geography of below. And you can choose to be in solidarity with the geography of below, the people who are most marginalized. And you can express that in just an infinite variety of ways. Everybody who supports or helps or volunteers or donates or works in that world is really practicing solidarity. And that's the basis of the relationship, I think, which is very powerful.
One of the questions I always like to ask people is kind of why are you, you know, what draws you to this work? But I think maybe you just answered that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough, you know, to remember I grew up in Minneapolis, went to school here, lived here most of my life. And, you know, I remember a Minneapolis without a lot of homelessness, you know, way back when I was young. And I remember that a city without homelessness. And we, you know, if you can remember that, you can also imagine a future without it pretty easily. This is not a intractable problem. People experiencing homelessness are not a separate class of people. It's an experience that happens because of a broken, unequal, two-tiered society based on race and class and these other things, and the misappropriation of resources. Government intervenes in markets all the time, whether it's price supports in the food market or maintenance of highways and roads, or the energy market is well subsidized. But for some reason, housing is sort of that last unsubsidized, unintervened area. And so the fallout has been widespread homelessness in every part of the United States. And so we have to confront those things. And as we do, we also want to be there for people who are experiencing it. And so, and I think Simpson is one of those organizations that does both of those things really well, because you are an organized community. And as somebody once said to me, I went to Southern Mexico and met a community organizer there. And he said that an organized community knows the solutions to its problems.
I think you and I started having this conversation a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, about the tension for resources, right? We've got people in crisis and we're trying to figure out how to respond to that crisis with tools like shelter. And at the same time, we've got a failing housing system, as you've already gone into some detail on. So there's those challenging moments where that tension exists between what to do with that next dollar or that next component of resource. And frankly, knowing that that tension exists, I think that a lot of us have just proceeded on with both and that they both need to happen and they both need to be our priority.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a tough thing when you don't have enough resources to decide what should happen next with opportunities that show up. And because we're all so spread out along this continuum of prevention and shelter system operation and housing development, that there's always that tension. One of the things I think about is Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted. He talks about the fact that the federal government actually intervenes very strongly in the housing market on behalf of homeowners to the tune of $175 billion a year for the mortgage interest deduction program. And most of that goes to high-income individuals, because you can, I think, own two houses valued up to $1 million each and get a large amount of your money back. He argues for a universal housing voucher for everybody under 30% of the area median income across the U.S. and the fact that it would only cost about $25 billion and we could cap that other program for homeowners, shift the money, and it would go a long way towards ending homelessness in the United States. And so, you know, these kind of obvious solutions are out there, and yet they don't seem to get quite enough traction to move forward.
So one thing I just want to say about the causes and conditions conversation there was simply that you mentioned recalling a world not too long ago, say 40 years ago, where homelessness was not nearly as prevalent as what we see today, that being a source of hope. And I completely agree with that. The other place where I really get a lot of hope is that the effectiveness of this system, this crisis response system that we've worked on, is really quite profound at this point, where we can work with individuals who are experiencing homelessness, resolve those crises to the tune of several thousand households a year. Then if we can support you in doing that upstream work, then the immediate crisis is fairly short term. It's that prevention work. It is really where we need to be doing bigger work as a community.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I left the Office to End Homelessness and started working on housing stability work, I went and interviewed the department heads of every department in Hennepin County, and their number one issue was housing. And yet none of them knew how to deal with it. Their staff were reluctant to engage in their clients around housing because they didn't understand it. And yet it was their biggest struggle. But if they began to understand it more and engage in it, I think we'd see a more effective or maybe fewer people ending up on the streets.
Yeah. So in the spirit of kind of solutions and where do we go from here, obviously the big project on the table for Simpson in our 40th year is this massive undertaking in terms of bricks and mortar and constructing a new building at the church site, which is three floors of that crisis response housing shelter, which will get our guests up out of the basement for the first time in 40 years and serves folks with more dignity and ultimately creates more capacity for housing placement outcomes through that shelter mechanism. And then, of course, 42 units of supportive housing is really kind of that first step housing for folks who have been experiencing long-term homelessness and taking that next step back to stability. So do you have any thoughts or reflections based on your experience about what doing shelter better kind of looks like, Mikkel?
I mean, in a sense, you're hosting people. I remember when I was working at the Harbor Light Center, which you're very familiar with, and one of our advisory members was the manager of the Hilton Hotel, and he was a gentleman from Switzerland who had come over to manage the Hilton when it first opened up. Very nice, posh hotel. And he came over, and I was giving him a tour, and he just remarked, you know, we're in the same business, you and I. You know, it's all about hospitality and decency and care and responding to people's needs. Everything we do, every service we provide, somehow has to be connected to or grounded in housing. Services offered without a route to housing are a waste of time and energy, in my humble opinion. And moving people back into housing has to be a critical piece of that. Again, it's about relationship and being in relationship with people. Having hope and carrying hope for people becomes incredibly important. And that belief that they can get on a route back into housing, that they can make some changes, that they're going to be supported is really important. We can talk about self-sufficiency or people sustaining themselves, but economics doesn't come into the conversation maybe as much as it should. And income building, you know, you need an income of $35,000 a year in this community to sustain yourself in an apartment, really, unless you have some form of subsidy, which we only have $14,000 available in Hennepin County for about 75,000 households. That's how fierce the competition is for a subsidized unit or place to live or a voucher. And so without that, and until that happens through good advocacy, we need to figure out that income piece, I think, for folks.
It's interesting that some days when we're looking at our demographics of the folks that are in our shelter on any particular night, it's actually the third of our guests that are working and who are underemployed or who are working seasonally or temp or not getting enough hours or not getting a high enough wage. Those are a lot of times the folks that tend to get stuck in the system because if you've got a documented disability, then we can get you lined up for one of those subsidies that you mentioned. If not, it is super challenging to make that leap to be able to get to a point where an individual can support their own housing expense needs, never mind damage deposit, first month's rents, you know, and those sorts of things.
And to get people to a higher wage at this point, you know, involves either training or a connection to other employment opportunities or more hours. Or I think wages peaked in the United States in 1973 in real fixed dollar terms and have been sort of declining for people on the lower income levels ever since, while the cost of things continues to go up. So the wage piece is just, I don't know if people realize how far wages have fallen over the decades.
With all of the pressure on the labor market right now, as we're a couple of years into a pandemic environment and facing the great resignation and all those kinds of things, I wonder if we're also starting to see kind of incidents of kind of the greatest generation stepping out of the workforce at a more rapid pace this past couple of years. And I wonder if the timing of that might not be beneficial to us with this new program to be able to have some more dedicated employment programming on site when we open this thing in late 2023.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see people attempt to reimagine shelter. And I think shelter as a place, not just for emergency overnight, but really as a place, as a safe container to start to move back into the flow of life. I mean, we talk about life internally in our area at the county as housing is the essential platform for life. Without housing, you can't engage, you can't get started, you can't. I mean, you think about how important housing is to everybody as the foundation of their lives. It's the place you get to go home to at the end of the day. You lick your wounds, you celebrate your victories, you are with the ones you love. Hopefully, it's a safe place to keep your things. I have things in my home that have been passed on to me from ancestors that are 100 years old. If without the housing, I wouldn't have that connection to the past and to family. I wouldn't have been able to raise two kids, work, be healthy, take care of health issues, all of that stuff. So shelter is a reimagined place to begin to get back to that essential platform. And with a sense of urgency.
I remember when you were with St. Stephen's, and just before I came to Simpson, we would have some conversations. I remember one of the things we talked about at that time was how do we become more collaborative to act more as a system as far as shelter is concerned. One of the things that's happened in the last 5 years is, you know, this notion of doing a single point of entry for shelter at the Adult Shelter Connect that is operated by Simpson. That was such a pivotal shift. In terms of us having better information about who's trying to access shelter and about ultimately being able to specialize some of those resources and really start to look at what are the necessary steps to help somebody get to stable housing.
And those came out of great conversations that we all had, you know, together in a room, you know, which is where some of the best ideas always happen, is just people getting together and carving out time to talk and strategize. And for Simpson to be able to step in and play that function for everybody in the system, all the agencies and all the partners, but it just is a more rational system. And it also guarantees somebody a bed for as long as they need it. And they can then start to think about tomorrow.
Yeah. The other thing that foments change, of course, is obviously pressure. And that was the next thing on this journey that really happened was we had a very large encampment at the Wall of Forgotten Natives at Franklin and Hiawatha a couple of years ago in Minneapolis. And we stepped in as a community and ultimately Simpson as an operator to operate what we called then a navigation center, which was a big temporary shelter. But it allowed us really to sort of try on some of the notions that we had for this project in terms of going to 24/7 operation and seeing what that looks like and bringing in really intensive services on site to have available to our guests during those daytime hours. And we were able to achieve some pretty remarkable outcomes in a relatively short time. We were only up and running there for about 6 months and more than 100 people were housed ultimately. And there was untold numbers of services around chemical dependency and mental health and healthcare treatments as well. So I think we knew, but it helped really cement some of the concepts that we wanted to bring into this new shelter project.
Yeah. Crisis can often lead to that, you know, that challenging a system or the all of the partners when something profound happens. I think that's been happening during COVID. I think the pandemic has pushed lots of change and new concepts and has put the urgency back into the system. I think about the hotels to housing project, resources being directed towards the shelter system that were needed, you know, all of these changes.
I can't not give a shout out to Wendy Wigman right now. I don't know if you recall or not, Mikkel, but 2 years ago when the governor issued the shelter at home order on March 17th of 2020, Wendy wrote a letter to the editor that afternoon, which was published the next day, which says shelter at home is all well and good if you have a home.
Yep.
And that really became kind of the rallying cry around 24/7 operation to move forward from there. Let's talk a little bit about what shelter access looked like before we had the Adult Shelter Connect office.
Well, I think there were a variety of ways to get into shelter because we had a variety of ways shelters were funded and operated. And it was very chaotic. It wasn't really unified at the time. You had a couple of larger shelters that you had to get a voucher for. I mean, way back in the day, there were shelters where you had to call a number and be interviewed in front of a staff person to be approved. And if you weren't approved, then you had to go right back out the door into the streets. And then you had the free shelters, the church-based shelters that had a lottery system where it was literally going on a Monday night into shelter, getting dinner, and then waiting to see if you were one of the lucky few who got an open bed. And if not, again, you were sent out the door into the night or told to go downtown to one of the big shelters. And so it was very chaotic and unorganized. I remember the first time, this was actually an idea that came from David Dahlberg, who at the time was a major in the Salvation Army and ran the Harbor Light Center when it first opened in its current location back in 1990. And he suggested to me that we should invite all of the shelter providers to lunch because nobody had met each other or knew each other. And so we sent out a little appeal letter. It was before the internet and email. Wrote a letter to people and said, you're invited to come have lunch and meet and have a conversation and talk about our shelters. And maybe we have things to talk about. And everybody showed up, like everybody. And it was like, wow, great to meet you. What's happening in your shelter? And people just started to talk and connect. And then the next meeting, we invited three county commissioners who had three very different positions on shelters and homelessness. And they came. And I think that began this sort of journey towards unity and this idea of many partners, one system. We're all in this together. You know, there were different people really sort of pushing and leading on those efforts. And usually it was people from the church-based shelters really pushing and foraging ahead and wanting that connection. But I think everybody ultimately did.
The real work of resolving an immediate crisis of housing instability or homelessness is really based in human relationship. And another quick learning that came from our work at the Navigation Center was we had the idea that somewhere between 70 and 100 is the right sort of scale for us to be able to operate in relationship. When we were at 170 folks, when we first, or 164, when we first opened at the Navigation Center, it was nothing but crowd control. And it wasn't until we were able to start working with folks, get some folks moved around and get down to somewhere under 100 before we really started to hit our groove with those relationship-based conversations and really find that work. So that is a critical element of what we hope to prove out with this model and be able to share with the rest of the community.
And I think that's an important, really important thing to acknowledge and recognize. When the Harbor Light first opened, actually each floor was a separate shelter and they were within those sort of numbers.
Yeah.
But as homelessness grew in the 90s, rather than opening more shelters, which was a tougher challenge, the fallback was, can you convert this lounge into another space for more people? Can you go to bunk beds from single beds? Can you know, and packing more and more people in and to places that already exist and trying to squeeze more people in, which is an easier route, you know, way to deal with the problem. But ultimately, then you end up with an inability to get back to that relational work. And so I think, you know, lesson learned is as homelessness ebbs and flows, depending on what's happening, can we have the ability to open more shelter beds when we need to, but maintain that size limit and that relationship aspect to get people back into housing?
As you know, having done this work as long as we both have, we always have to answer this question, right? I mean, the notion of an employment program, the notion of doing our own chemical dependency treatment, for example, these sorts of matters where there is good quality service already happening in the community, and can we benefit from partnership as opposed to building from scratch and being redundant, is one that it continues to be very much front and center for us. So we are looking forward to utilizing those key relationships, healthcare for the homeless, for example, as a healthcare partner at the new location and other established organizations. And one of the design principles is this notion that we can flex our space in this shelter model and carve out portions of our sleeping rooms. So we can, if it turns out that we need 20 beds for a certain type of senior services or 15 beds for shelter guests who are GLBTQ or, you know, whatever the case may be, we can tailor the way that services are delivered in the physical space to serve subpopulations, which ultimately I think gives us the capacity to be adaptive to those changing needs that you're touching on.
Yeah.
Final question, sort of on a related note, is there anything that you wish people knew about homelessness and housing stability that could help make meaningful change?
Well, I always go back to the level of opportunity, and it's really about economics and systems. It's not about people and their own, you know, it's not sin or sickness. It's a system.
Policy and priority, if you will.
Policy and priority and allocation of resources and lack of resources. I mean, really, this all started 40 years ago because of federal budget decisions, honestly, and lack of intervention in a failed housing market, major shifts in priorities in spending away from domestic spending into other mainly defense spending and other things. I mean, it was a real shift, and it was a real visible, noticeable, oh my gosh, what's happening in our community? Who are all these folks? What's going on? And when it's not about people, then it gets to be about, this is a problem that we can solve and that will have an immediate impact and have a benefit to everybody. And it would cost something, but it would cost a lot less than the status quo.
To answer my own question about what I wish people understood is the point you just made is for folks to understand how radical the shift in resource allocation was away from affordable and supportive housing under the federal administration in the early 80s to the tune of 80% cut to the HUD budget that year. And I don't think people understand that that's really a lot of what we deal with today can be traced directly back to that. And then the other thing is that you mentioned earlier is that far and away, the largest housing subsidy program at the federal level is the mortgage interest tax deduction, which does not serve those folks that are in greatest need and most greatly affected by housing instability.
It's welfare. It's money right out of the national treasury. And when you tell a homeowner they're on welfare, they may not appreciate that, but it's certainly a valid way to describe what happens for homeowners who do have a mortgage. We did a survey of families in shelter a few years back, and there was nobody in who came to our shelter system that was making $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a year. It was all part-time workers on average making $10 an hour, making $12,000 a year, $8,000 a year on this income, and trying to, and then having to go on public assistance because they couldn't get full-time even though they wanted to, and ending up in shelter because just there's no place for a family to live if you're a part-time service sector worker. You know, and those are just basic things that we can address.
Mikkel, thank you so much for your time this afternoon in this broad-ranging conversation. Thank you for everything that you have brought to this work, all of your heart and soul over the course of the past 30 years, and for giving us a little bit of a glimpse into that.
Oh, it's been time well spent getting to have this conversation. It's been really energizing, and it reminds me of all the great things happening in your world and at Simpson and all of the things that are about to unfold here. So it's been really enjoyable for me. So I appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to our first episode of Voices of Simpson. Over the course of this series, we'll hear stories from the Simpson Housing Services community, from staff, volunteers, participants, and more. We hope you'll join us on this journey. If you're in the Minneapolis area and you are a single adult who needs shelter, you can call Adult Shelter Connect at 612-248-2350. If you have custody of minor children and you need shelter, you can call the Family Shelter Line at 612-348-9410. Voices of Simpson is a podcast by Simpson Housing Services and is produced by Mary Beth Romslow and written by Hannah Jones. Special thanks for this episode go out to Mikkel Beckman, Rachel MacGyver-Morey, and Elizabeth Leffler. To learn more about Simpson Housing Services, please visit us online at www.simpsonhousing.org.